is the light shine when they're trying to put our lights out.
On this Independence Day, we look at different definitions of America through music. It's Friday. Happy 4th of July. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang. As immigration agents continue rounding up people for deportation, some Black communities are taking steps to prevent hostile encounters with law enforcement.
I think this is really an issue of solidarity and ensuring that we recognize that if they come for one of us, they come for all of us.
Meanwhile, the Trump administration is withholding grants for adult education nationwide. That could leave more than a million students in the lurch.
Adult education is a talent pipeline into workforce and to community colleges. That talent pipeline will be immediately cut in half.
And a short history of competitive eating after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump is preparing to sign a massive tax cut and spending bill into law at this hour. The legislation pumps billions of dollars into defense and border enforcement while cutting Medicaid and food assistance programs. NPR's Tamara Keith reports Democrats warn it could drive up inflation and increase the national debt.
Democrats have been quite united in branding this as a tax cut that will overwhelmingly benefit the wealthy and big businesses, paid for by making life harder for the working class. They point to an independent analysis that found this bill could add trillions to the deficit and kick millions of people off their health coverage. White House officials point out that individual pieces of the bill are popular, even if public polling finds the broader package isn't. So with the midterms coming up next year, the president and his party are working to convince voters that this bill will make their lives better.
That's NPR's Tamara Keith reporting. Palestinian health officials say airstrikes carried out by Israel have left at least 100 people dead in the Gaza Strip. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports the attacks come ahead of a potential ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas.
Israeli and Hamas officials have said there are positive signs that they're ready to negotiate a ceasefire in Gaza. In the meantime, hospitals in Gaza are flooded with the injured and killed from Israeli attacks. NPR's Enes Baba visited Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, where dozens of Palestinians were being treated. He met Othman Abdu, whose niece had just lost her three children to an Israeli strike on a school-turned-shelter. Abdu had a message for both the sides trying to strike a deal. Enough malicious politics, he said. Have mercy on us. There are innocent people being killed. President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are expected to meet in Washington on Monday to discuss a ceasefire. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Newly released documents show the Trump administration instructed tech companies to ignore a federal law banning the popular social media site TikTok. NPR's Bobby Allen reports the new letters are public as a result of Freedom of Information Act lawsuits.
Congress passed a law last year that banned TikTok on national security grounds unless it severed ties with its Chinese owner, ByteDance. The Supreme Court upheld the law. But in newly released letters, Attorney General Pat Bondi told Apple and Google to ignore the law since it would interfere with the president's constitutional duties. Legal experts say telling private companies to ignore a federal law stretches the limits of Trump's presidential power. One legal scholar called it breathtaking. The White House did not return a request for comment. Trump has said a new TikTok buyer will be announced in the coming days. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. Air traffic controllers have walked off the job in France. About 40% of airline flights at airports in Paris were canceled today. One of the two unions leading the strike says there aren't enough employees to handle a surge in air travel and that inflation is cutting into salaries. This year's A Capital Fourth concert will honor the 250th anniversary of the nation's military. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports the musical acts include the Beach Boys, the Temptations, and the National Symphony Orchestra.
There are connections between some of the musicians performing this year. Louisiana natives Trombone Shorty and Lauren Daigle have performed together, blending New Orleans jazz funk with contemporary Christian music. And the country duo Low Cash has worked with the Beach Boys. The two groups will perform a Beach Boys song together. Everybody's got surfing,
surfing US. USA.
A Capital Fourth begins on PBS at 8 p.m. Eastern and closes with live fireworks over the National Mall. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
At least three people are dead after a severe thunderstorm hit parts of central New Jersey last night. Officials say the storm caused widespread damage across several towns, leaving tens of thousands of customers without electricity. Emergency crews are working to clear dozens of downed trees and power lines, which have blocked several roads in the region. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It is 4:06 on this Friday afternoon, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. The Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources offers the Lawns to Legumes program, which aims to increase habitat for at-risk pollinators in residential settings. The deadline to apply for the 2026 season is November 30th. Find more info and apply at bluethumb.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ailsa Chang. Independence Day means different things to each of us. And on this 249th birthday for America, we're going to spend some time looking at different definitions of America by revisiting NPR's American Anthem series, which had the simple goal of telling 50 stories about 50 songs that have become galvanizing forces in American culture. We start with a song that many of you will probably remember from childhood.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine.
This Critic Eric Deggans looked at how the beloved children's song, This Little Light of Mine, became a civil rights anthem.
Sometimes experts say songs like This Little Light of Mine start off as children's folk songs, which become spirituals sung everywhere from churches to prison work camps.
Everywhere I go, I'm gonna let it shine.
As the civil rights movement grew in the 1950s and 60s, singers changed the lyrics to reference their struggles. These new versions were known as freedom songs. It might seem odd to call such an innocent-sounding song defiant, but that's exactly how blues singer Betty Mae Fikes felt when she created her classic version of This Little Light of Mine in 1963. She improvised the lyrics after a protest in which several of her friends had been attacked.
And I'm thinking, you know, how does the light shine when they're trying to put our lights out? So everybody was taking verses. In order to come in, I just went into the slave call. And all of a sudden, I just started adding our oppressors in the song. Tell Jim Clark I'm going to let it shine. And as I added my oppressors, here other people in the audience began to shout out, tell the KKK, tell our president. It was like being free.
Still, one question persists. Why has This Little Light of Mine survived for so long? Robert Darden, a professor at Baylor University who's written about the song in at least two books, has a theory.
If you've asked some of the survivors of the civil rights movement, as I did, survivors who sang these songs for protection and for courage, why This Little Light of Mine survives and is still sung, they would look at me straight in the eye and say, because those songs are anointed. And as an academic, I have no way to refute that, nor do I want to.
There's a little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine.
That was Robert Darden talking to NPR's Eric Deggans about This Little Light of Mine. The word anthem connotes something big, right? Something that unites listeners, but also maybe something that challenges them. Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man was composed in 1942, and since then it has been heard everywhere. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco looked into why this song continues to command so much attention.
Aaron Copland began his fanfare with dramatic percussion. It heralds something big, exciting, heroic. Then simple trumpet notes ascend.
It's a piece that feels like it was written by God and not by a human.
Jazz trumpet player and composer Terrence Blanchard.
Whenever I hear it, it stops me in my tracks and it makes me reflect on the goodness of man, really. And I know that sounds corny for some, but it really makes me think about it. At the end of the day, you know, most people in this country are good, God-fearing people. Honestly, that could have been our national anthem. It has that type of spirit to it.
By 1942, the U.S. had entered World War II, and composer Aaron Copland was inspired by a speech Vice President Henry A. Wallace gave to rally Americans.
Some have spoken of the American century. I say that the century on which we are entering, the century which will come into being after this war, can be and must be the century of the common man.
And the common man deserved a fanfare, Copland once said, remarking it was the common man, after all, who was doing all the dirty work in the war and the army. NPR asked listeners to reflect on Aaron Copland's fanfare.
My name is Lynn Gilbert, and I live in Bristol, Maine. My career was in IT for a utility company. And in spite of the current political landscape, I guess I still believe that there is an American dream of peace and prosperity for everyone. And music that soars and inspires like this piece does brings hope for the future. It's powerful, it's direct, and it's really just American. I love it. Thank you, Aaron Copland.
All of that in a piece that's under 4 minutes long. Mandalita El Barco, NPR News.
Lynn Neary first heard Bob Dylan's The Times They Are Changin' when she was barely a teenager. Once she heard the song, she says, pretty much nothing was the same after that.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam.
This protest song from 1963 continues to find new meaning for new generations. In 2018, thousands of young people gathered on the National Mall for the March for Our Lives in response to the Parkland school shooting. Singer Jennifer Hudson closed the event with this song. And she was backed by a choir of young people.
All right, let's run it from the top.
Ranging in age from 13 to 30, they meet regularly to rehearse in Columbia, Maryland.
Come gather round people wherever you roam.
Gather round and around.
Choir director Jonathan Ball says he was surprised when the choir was asked to sing The Times They Are A-Changin' at the march. He didn't know the song, and neither did most of the members of the choir. Ball says as they started to rehearse, the lyrics took on more meaning for all of them. He began imagining what it would be like to sing those words, come senators, congressmen, please heed the call, on the National Mall.
In my mind, when I was arranging the part, I was like, I hope the president hears this. I hope the senators, the congressmen are actually listening. And like a movie almost, like, you know, like they hear the music and they just like write a new law.
Come senators and congressmen, please heed the call. Don't you stand in the doorway. Don't you block up the hall.
Erica Edmond is the lead singer. She says the full impact of the song really hit when the choir sang it during the march.
Because we were there looking at all of these people, I would look into the crowd seeing people crying. You know, you had people that are begging, screaming for change. So it makes it easy for me to sing the song because it means so much to what I've seen now.
Choir member Theron Fowler was amazed that one song could be so powerful.
This anthem, it brought us together for something bigger than ourselves. No matter what race, what culture, background, religious, whatever, it brought everyone together.
And so a new generation takes up the anthem that inspired young people more than 50 years ago. But it's not a song that looks to the past. It's an anthem of hope for a future where change is always possible.
NPR's Lynn Neary on The Times They Are Changin'. NPR also asked you to send us stories about your personal anthems. And a number of you wrote about the Simon and Garfunkel song, America. It's a road trip song that's about more than just traveling, right? Listeners said it speaks to a quest for meaning. Here, in their own words, are Eugene Lisansky, Yael Cohen, and Val Sullivan.
The whole part where he says, I'm empty and aching and I don't know why, just really is kind of how I feel as an American right now.
I'm empty and aching and I don't know why. Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for America.
Many of us, myself included, have been stuck on the New Jersey Turnpike, and it's not a place that you would really think that you would find meaning.
Realizing that everybody is looking for America, what does that mean?
For me, getting to know America is more about the questions that we ask than the sort of sureness that we might reach in our own experience.
I don't know whether we ever did find it or whether this was just a quixotic quest, but I think all of us are still searching for America and hoping to find it and define it and give it meaning, and we all do that in our own way.
Whether you have found your America or you're still searching, we wish you all a very, very happy Independence Day.
I've got some real estate here in my bag.
This is NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your daily dose of phonology. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Today is the 4th of July. Happy 4th of July. And in 1994, I was finding ripe blueberries on the 4th of July. I encourage you to get out and explore the woods a little bit. Maybe you'll find some ripe blueberries. What could be more American than a lovely blueberry pie on a sunny 4th of July day? I can't think of a better way to celebrate our independence than to bake a beautiful, tasty, delicious blueberry pie. Happy 4th of July, everybody.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kresge Foundation. Established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump administration's crackdown on immigrants is fueling conversations around the country about law enforcement tactics and the rights of immigrants and those accused of violating laws. It has also stirred a conversation in Black communities where organizers say it's a reminder that they have long been targets of aggressive policing. From member station GBH, Paul Singer has the story of a Boston-based effort to remind Black people of their rights when confronted by law enforcement.
Ron Bell walks into a bookstore in a mostly Black neighborhood in Boston.
I got something for you.
Bell runs a grassroots organization called Dunk the Vote, focusing on voting rights and civic engagement. But as social media fills with videos showing federal agents arresting immigrants off the streets, he wants Black communities to remember that they are at risk as well.
I got some complimentary copies of the Know Your Rights Guide.
Since February, he's been handing out passport-sized guides called the Black Book in churches, barbershops, and restaurants.
I'm feeling a lot of traction. It's gotten to a point that I'm integrating into everything I do.
The book provides basic information on the right to remain silent, to ask to see a warrant, or to ask an officer to identify themselves. There's also contact information for the ACLU and other civil rights organizations.
I carry them around with me now. I mean, because people are calling me. Well, anybody more than Black books?
So far, he says, he's given away about 2,000 of them in Boston area neighborhoods, at events, and to other community organizations that have asked for them. Black civil rights organizations around the country say they're getting similar requests.
There are a number of Know Your Rights trainings that are happening across the country.
Jerrica Richardson is the Senior Vice President for Equitable Justice and Strategic Initiatives at the National Urban League.
The division that I lead has been contacted by a number of our affiliates asking for guides, asking to support or participate in video production so that they can share this broad and wide.
Richardson says it's not just Latinos that are at risk of arrest. The Black community is also vulnerable.
Within the Black community, we have a huge Afro-Latino population. We have an Afro-Caribbean population. We have an African population. All of these communities are going to be subject to some of the same challenges.
Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell, like some Democratic officials elsewhere, has issued a Know Your Rights guide outlining what federal agents can and cannot do, but she admits that's hard to enforce.
It's still very hard to hold the federal administration and ICE officials accountable for the activity we are currently seeing in Massachusetts.
Black activists say it's a problem they've had with police accountability for generations. The Boston Police Department did not respond to a request for comment. Since 2003, the NAACP has produced a guide called The 411 on the 5-0. It's much like Ron Bell's Black Book, listing the rights a person has when confronted by police.
This is a situation that's been going on for the entire history of the organization.
That's Wisdom Cole, the NAACP's Senior National Advocacy Director. He says the immigration crackdown is an opportunity for communities of color to unite.
I think this is really an issue of solidarity and ensuring that we recognize that if they come for one of us, they come for all of us.
Ron Bell, the Boston organizer, says he's preparing Black men if someone comes for them.
What normally happens to Black men or Black boys, you learn these things once you get arrested. Then you find out, wow, I didn't know I had rights.
With that, he steps into another diner to hand out more Black books.
I got this for you, man. To Know Your Rights guy.
For NPR News, I'm Paul Singer in Boston.
In the past 52 years, the Park Slope Food Co-op in Brooklyn has become a local institution. In exchange for cheap fruit and vegetables, member owners work occasional shifts and make group decisions on the store operations. But since the beginning of the war in Gaza, the cooperative has become divided over talk of a boycott of Israeli goods. NPR's Vanessa Romo has more.
For many in progressive foodie circles, the Park Slope Food Co-op is a whole scene.
So you're going to get amazing farm fresh eggs and various kimchis or tofus at very good prices.
That's Ramon Maislin, who's walking me through the tightly packed store. He jokes that over the decades, the place has become somewhat infamous for impassioned, yet completely mundane disputes. Exhibit A.
Should the co-op sell meat? Should the co-op sell beer?
But the latest fight is a lot more fraught. Since the breakout of the war in October 2023, the membership has been roiled by conflict. One group, called the Park Slope Food Co-op Members for Palestine, wants the store to join the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, also known as BDS. Now, they're being accused of fomenting anti-Semitism by several members of the pro-Israel coalition Co-op for Unity, which opposes the idea of a boycott. Sandra Shavitz is a member of that group. She's Jewish, and she says she was accosted by a BDS supporter last year while handing out anti-boycott flyers.
And then all of a sudden, he says to me, "Are you a Zionist? She's a Zionist! She's a Zionist!"
That incident, combined with a few others, eventually drove Maislin to file a complaint with New York's Division of Human Rights. In it, he alleges Jewish members are experiencing anti-Semitism and discrimination and that the co-op isn't doing anything about it. That's launched an investigation that's still ongoing. Both the co-op and the state agency declined to comment on its status. Meanwhile, several pro-BDS members say they don't want to dismiss the incidents that have been reported, but they say that it's only a handful of bad actors and they don't accurately reflect the values of the boycott movement.
Our co-op has like a long, beautiful legacy of social justice and food justice.
That's Elise Barr, who's been a co-op member since 1978. She's supported previous boycotts and says that as a Jewish member, she's on board with this one too.
We've boycotted Chile during Pinochet. We supported the United Farm Workers Union and boycotted U.S. grapes and non-union farms.
The store actually only stocks a handful of goods from Israel, like Passover specialty items and peppers in the winter. But Dan Kaminsky, another Jewish member who supports the boycott, says that's not the point.
For me, the point is more, we're the oldest and largest cooperative in America. So what we do does have implications for all cooperatives across the country.
For the past few months, this conflict has been playing out against the backdrop of an election. Two seats on the co-op's six-member board of directors were opening up. Both sides ran candidates, which included Kaminsky. They all hoped to shape the leadership of the co-op, and by extension, the debate on the boycott. In the end, on the evening of June 24th, some roughly 200 members gathered in a Prospect Park building to vote on new leadership. The result? Pro-BDS-endorsed candidates lost. One seat went to a Co-op for Unity candidate. The second went to Brandon West, a self-described middle-of-the-road candidate who was running for re-election on a platform of improving governance and decision-making.
It was, frankly, like a little surprised the amount of yes votes for me.
The day after the vote, Elise Barr was back at the co-op.
I'm disappointed, but I'm not surprised.
All she wants is the chance to actually hold a vote on the boycott, and she might actually get it. Even though West wasn't endorsed by the co-op members for Palestine, when it comes to a boycott, he says,
I personally support it, pretty strongly.
So, with West still on the board, it turns out there is enough support among board members to potentially advance a boycott vote, as soon as they can agree on when to hold it. For NPR News, I'm Vanessa Romo.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. The KAXE Newsroom has created a map of northern Minnesota farmers markets throughout our region, from places like Park Rapids to Reamer and Black Duck to Crosby. Most markets run through September or October. Find the map at KAXE.org. And we receive support from the Watermark Arts Center in downtown Bemidji, with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. WatermarkArtsCenter.org. Now for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As the Trump administration looks to combine multiple fire agencies under one organization, firefighter numbers are dwindling. Northwest Public Broadcasting's Lauren Patterson reports on how the Nez Perce tribe is stepping up despite the challenges.
Three young firefighters are standing under the hot sun in Lapway, Idaho, doing an engine check on one of their fire trucks. All of them are tribal members and firefighters for the Nez Perce tribe. Riston Bullock is going into his 13th season. He says he does this job because he's dedicated to protecting the land and his community.
Now that I've been in fire for so long, it's kind of more being the first one to respond, put the fires out.
A big challenge here in Idaho and across the nation is that there aren't enough people to help.
We're losing firefighters. The numbers are going down.
People can still volunteer, but
we need people at the shop ready to go when those fires start.
Across from the shop in the air-conditioned office, Jeff Handel, the fire management officer, is on the phone trying to schedule repairs for fire trucks.
What I need is I've got a couple rigs that need radios put
in. He's also worried the younger generation doesn't seem too interested in firefighting.
It's pretty tough in today's world when you can get a job and work from home and do okay financially. Why would you want to go out and do the firefighting thing, which is very hard work?
Back at the shop, the firefighters are organizing equipment like ropes and hatchets. There could be changes coming to how the Nez Perce Tribal Fire Crew works with other agencies in the region. The Trump administration is trying to merge all federal firefighting into a single agency. That could mean shifting thousands of jobs around just as fire season is ramping up. Bullock says he's not sure how that would work.
I feel like it'll just kind of be a new name. But I still feel like we'll still have our shops and everything here. We'll be mixed out through each other. And
approximately $1.2 billion will be requested as part of the new Wildland Fire Service budget. For now, Bullock and the rest of the crew aren't giving it too much thought. They're busy getting ready for the next call. Reporting in Lapway, Idaho, I'm Lauren Patterson.
A group of researchers found gaps in how death certificates are maintained with implications for Native Americans' health. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
Researchers from prestigious universities to indigenous communities studied death certificates from 2008 to 2019. They found Native Americans have a life expectancy of roughly 72 years old. The national average is 79. That's a much bigger gap than official stats show, says Jacob Bohr. He's an associate professor at the Boston University School of Public Health and the study's lead author.
American Indian populations have been subjected to deliberate policies of physical and cultural erasure for centuries. These patterns have contributed to today's economic and physical marginalization and deprivation and to poor outcomes in these populations.
Bohr and his team uncovered another problem. Death certificates for at least 40% of Native Americans failed to identify them as American Indian or Alaska Native. In most cases, their race was misreported as white. I'm Caleb Radel.
The New Mexico Early Childhood Education and Care Department announced this week the appointment of Joni Suena as Assistant Secretary for Native American Early Education and Care. The citizen of Cochiti Pueblo recently served as Special Projects Coordinator at the state's Indian Affairs Department, focusing on issues including Indian education and MMIP, and previously served as Communications Director for the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. Her new position will work on strengthening state-tribal early childhood partnerships. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Skugtash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. An estimated 16 million Americans could lose their health care coverage between funding cuts and policy changes in the federal reconciliation bill. That's according to a nonpartisan government analysis. About half of that loss is expected to come from changes that could lead to hundreds of billions of dollars in Medicaid cuts. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Abigail Ruman reports that advocates and experts warn people may not know they're losing their coverage until it's too late.
Tracy Hutchings Getz talks to a lot of people. It's a big part of how she helps them navigate and understand the complicated landscape of Indiana Medicaid, which includes over 30 different programs.
There's such a kind of alphabet soup of branding and logos and different things going on.
Hutchings Getz is an organizer with Hoosier Action, a community advocacy group. She says the branding may have been used to remove some of the stigma around the program, which provides coverage for people with lower incomes or disabilities, as well as older adults. For example, somebody in Indiana's Medicaid expansion program may know it simply as Medicaid, or the Healthy Indiana Plan, also known as HIP, or even just by which insurer manages their coverage.
It is just objectively confusing, and it is really confusing to have this different branding, to have the insurance companies, to have Medicaid. Like, it really is hard to follow.
The branding can vary not just between programs, but also between states. The Indiana Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, is also called Hoosier HealthWise. In Georgia, it's Peach Care for Kids. In Vermont, it's Dr. Dinosaur. Hutchings Getz says even when people are aware of the programs, it's still difficult to follow Medicaid policy discussions, like right now. The federal changes and cuts are one part of a bigger budget bill that's over 1,000 pages long.
All of that contributes to people feeling confused and scared.
Indiana, like several other states, isn't just preparing to implement changes from federal lawmakers. The Indiana Family and Social Services Administration is also working on changes from state lawmakers. Both the state and federal legislation include implementing work reporting requirements and increased eligibility checks and monitoring. Indiana's interim Medicaid director, Mitch Robe, says the state isn't sure how it plans on handling the increased administrative burden created by the new policies.
In terms of administering it, it will be unquestionably a challenge, but we'll face that challenge.
That means people don't know what the changes will look like in practice, which can lead to people losing coverage because they don't know when or how the changes are being implemented. Leo Cuello is a research professor at Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. Even before the most recent changes to the federal legislation by the Senate, he was concerned that people may not understand the effects of the reconciliation bill.
We're at the tip of the iceberg in terms of public reaction because there are so many people who are at risk and don't quite understand that they're in the crosshairs.
Cuello says it's difficult to help people track what's happening, even for experts like himself.
By hiding the ball as long as they did and sort of not showing exactly where they were going to make their cuts, it's been hard to communicate to people, here are the risks for you.
Tracy Hutchings Getz, the advocate in Indiana, says it's understandable that people don't feel like they have the time, energy, or even agency to do anything about the changes. She says connecting with people can help them believe they have and deserve a role in shaping public policy.
Lifts that seemed impossible, changes that seemed inevitable, suddenly become something that can move because we're not doing it alone.
Hutchings Getz says just by talking about it, people can stay informed and engaged, even when it comes to something as complicated as Medicaid. For NPR News, I'm Abigail Ruman in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
More than a million people across the country are enrolled in adult education every year. Many of these programs rely on federal funds to pay for English as a second language instruction and GED classes. Now, funding for these programs may be at risk because the Trump administration is withholding grant money that traditionally is disbursed on July 1st. Sarah Ash in Austin reports on the possible impact that this funding pause will have nationwide.
Maricela Juarez dropped out of school when she completed eighth grade, and soon after, she became a teen mom.
By age 25, Waters had 6 children, and her dreams of establishing a career and moving out of public housing felt unachievable. Her formal education interrupted, she worked in construction and cleaned houses to pay the bills. It wasn't until her youngest got to high school that Waters enrolled in GED classes at Austin Community College in 2013.
It took me a long time to get through all the material that I needed to get. The math part was very, very hard.
Waters' GED opened the door for her to get an associate's degree in 2020. Last December, she got her bachelor's from Texas State University in criminal justice.
I feel extremely blessed. I just thought it was, you know, like, impossible dream.
Roughly $716 million in funding for adult education programs like the one that helped Juarez is being withheld from states as the Department of Education reviews funding for a number of different grant programs. This money pays for GED classes, workforce training, and English language instruction. Kathy Dowdy, the adult education dean at Austin Community College, said delaying these funds puts their programs at risk.
Since COVID, we're especially needed to help students realize their strengths. We help them find their way. It's a second chance.
Adult education helps people meet their goals and offers certifications in high-demand fields. That includes HVAC repair, healthcare, and manufacturing. Sharon Bonney, CEO of the national advocacy organization Coalition on Adult Basic Education, said she fears many of the people enrolled in adult education programs could have their studies interrupted in the next few weeks.
Closures will start immediately. We've already heard from a number of local programs. This is going to be across the board, mass closures and layoffs.
These dollars usually flow to states from the Department of Education as part of the Workforce Innovation and Opportunities Act, which passed in 2014. Bonnie estimates that of the more than $700 million on hold, California was slated to receive the most at about $117 million. Texas was second on the list at around $78 million. Florida and New York were both set to receive about $50 million. Bonnie said this will have ripple effects beyond the individual students impacted.
Adult education is a talent pipeline into workforce and to community colleges. That talent pipeline will be immediately cut in half.
This will make it harder for employers to fill jobs and for workers to increase their earnings. Even with the federal grant, Texas typically only has funding to cover about 3% of the need for adult education in the state. That's according to estimates by the Texas Workforce Investment Council. Many programs, including the one at Austin Community College that supports English language education, were operating with long wait lists. Here's Dowdy again.
And that was with the funding. Now without the funding, that wait list will just grow.
Maricela Juarez says she is proof that adult education changes lives. She now works at Austin Community College, helping students seeking career training.
When you're living in a below poverty or poverty level, you just don't think that you can make it out of there unless you actually see someone that has been where you are and you can see that as an example.
But for now, that pipeline for second chances is contingent on the Trump administration releasing federal funding. I'm Sarah Ash in Austin.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. KAXE's future is on the line. The U.S. House recently voted to rescind federal funding for public media. The Senate is next. Public media like KAXE brings you fact-checked news, connection to community, and great music. Free to everyone with no paywall. Public radio stations play a critical role in getting timely, accurate emergency information to the public, especially in rural and underserved areas. Proposed cuts will hit rural and tribal stations the hardest. Now's the time. Tell Congress, protect the funding that keeps KAXE and stations like us on the air. ProtectMyPublicMedia.org will connect you to your elected officials. Don't forget, your voice matters. Now it's time for North Star Stories here on member-supported KAXE KBXE.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
Today, why a Minnesota company is suing Google. Then, how Somali food is spicing the Twin Cities. And Amazon is expanding its presence in southeast Minnesota. I'm Chantel Sings. A Minnesota solar company is suing Google and its artificial intelligence, or AI, feature. Wolf River Electric Solar Service is suing Google, claiming its AI overview component provided false information about the company. Last fall, the AI overview claimed Minnesota's attorney general was suing Wolf River for misleading and deceptive sales practices. But that wasn't true. The company claims it lost significant business because of the false information. The case recently moved from state to federal court. Up next, a Somali-owned food business in Minneapolis is expanding, not just in size, but in reach. Faya Adam explains.
Behind it is all of Hoyo's production facility, which we're very proud to show you.
Joni Essenberg is Hoyo's business development director. Hoyo is a Somali-owned food business making its mark across Minnesota. Hoyo is bringing sambusas to grocery stores, school cafeterias, and the state fair, all while building cultural connections through food.
Hoyo means mother in Somalia.
Gita Worcester is the CEO of Hoyo. Matt Glover, a co-owner of Hoyo, helped co-found the organization after seeing a need in his neighborhood.
And it was chosen because Matt Glover found a lot of women in his neighborhood that were having trouble finding jobs, and he kept hearing Hoyo being called out as the kids were running around in the neighborhood.
Sisters Halima, Mariam, and Asha Mohammed from Somalia founded Hoyo along with Matt Glover. A church and a common desire to create jobs by and for Somali women helped bring them together.
They thought, well, they're authentic Somali recipes that we're talking about, and the goal here would be to have something that would feel authentic.
Sambusas are a triangular pastry with a crispy exterior and savory filling, typically made of beef or lentils. Hoyo sold its first sambusas at farmers markets.
A couple of local co-ops, food co-ops, asked about us being able to have some product that they could sell in their frozen food section. Hence, we developed the frozen food sambusa model.
After Hoyo's frozen sambusas became available in stores, the Rochester School District reached out about offering the item in their schools.
We're in about 30 school districts, which equals about 300 individual schools in the state.
They hope to bring on more districts at a statewide nutrition conference this summer.
School districts that are already purchasing our sambusas bring other school districts over to talk to us.
Hoyo is now getting ready for its state fair debut in partnership with Midtown Global Market.
It's going to give us the ability to have staff working more hours during the summer and spending some time actually out at the fair.
The fair is a rare chance for production staff to step away from their usual work days.
When you sit in the food production facility making the sambusas, you don't get to see the enjoyment of the people that are tasting the food. So this is going to give them a really nice opportunity.
Hoyo is moving to a new commercial kitchen, which will help them double their production. And soon, they'll be in Lunds and Byerly's.
And we're looking to go into additional larger grocery chains that will be able to have the production facility for when we're in this new space.
Hoyo is hoping to increase its staff by creating a second shift, something that was impossible at the previous facility.
One of the goals for this company has always been to help people, oftentimes with their first job in this country.
This is Faya Adam for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Massive online retailer Amazon is laying the ground for a new delivery center in southeast Minnesota. The company purchased a plot of land earlier this summer in Stuartville, just south of Rochester. While a company spokesperson did not provide a timeline for the project, they did say the goal is to improve delivery times. The new center is part of a larger effort by Amazon to build out its delivery network in rural communities across the country. Some local residents say they're excited by the jobs this could bring, while others are concerned about increased traffic.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. So today is one of the top American holidays for eating, right? I mean, there is Thanksgiving, of course, but the 4th of July features some serious cookouts. And don't forget the de facto Super Bowl of competitive eating, Nathan's famous hot dog eating contest in Coney Island, New York. A couple years ago, our producer Matt Ozug set out to learn more about why competitive eating is such a big deal in America. So he spoke to some experts, and this 4th of July, we decided it is time to give that story another listen.
Sometimes I wake up in the morning and I remember that I spent 2 years in the 2000s following competitive eating around the country and the world. You know, I saw some things that I can never forget, even if I wanted to. My name is Jason Fagoni, and I'm the author of Horsemen of the Esophagus, Competitive Eating, and the Big Fat American Dream. Most people are familiar with the Nathan's famous hot dog eating contest. That's the one that's broadcast every year on ESPN, but there's all kinds of other eating contests.
Cheeseburger eating champion!
For burgers, for cakes, for cannolis.
23 cannoli during last year's face-off.
French fries.
French fry eating championship of the world!
Just the craziest kind of wildest, most grotesque, nonsensical, you know, and kind of fun pageants that I'd ever had a chance to witness. One of the most intense experiences of my life was attending the Philadelphia Wing Bowl, the country's premier chicken wing eating contest. 15,000 to 20,000 actual fans packed into a sports arena in Philadelphia at 7 a.m., then there's this whole other aspect of eating contests in Japan.
Food Battle Club!
They come with greatly expanded production values. There are, you know, lasers and explosions and, you know, dramatic music. There's a lot more ingenuity in the kind of the structuring of the contest itself, whereas in America, the contests tend to be more just about sort of sheer volume. Competitive eating goes back centuries. It's not only an American thing.
We have record of a famous competitive eater going back to the 17th century. My name is Eric Grundhauser, and I am a writer and journalist. There was a farmer by the name of Nicholas Wood. Some of the impressive meals that Wood was known to have consumed included eating 7 dozen rabbits in one sitting, entire pigs, 12 loaves of bread that had been soaked in ale. He passed out afterwards, but he made it. Wood earned a number of pretty incredible nicknames. The most exorbitant paunchmonger, Duke Allpaunch, and the Kentish Tenterbelly. Unfortunately, his body was pretty well destroyed from all the eating. He had lost all but one of his teeth after trying to eat an entire mutton shoulder. Wood finally threw in the towel and said, "I can't do this any longer."
There are a lot of different cultures that have kind of invented eating contests independently at different points in history. And for the first few hundred years after the American Revolution, eating contests were a regular feature at 4th of July celebrations. And then this started to change a little in the 1970s when Nathan's Famous Hot Dogs created a hot dog contest on the 4th of July. You know, the eaters in that era were mostly big guys from Long Island, right? These are like classic kings of the backyard barbecue. And in the 1990s, these two brothers from New York took over the Nathan's Famous accounts, George and Richard Shea. And in that age, everyone who was competing in the contest was kind of in on the joke. The eaters had silly nicknames. There was a guy named Frank Large Della Rosa.
Dominic the Dogginator Cardo.
Ed Cookie Jarvis.
Uncle Charles Hardy, Brooklyn, New York.
Eric Badlands Booker.
I'm gonna quench my thirst to my heart's content and do it in record time.
Who is also a rapper and records competitive eating themed rap songs.
Somebody say Chuck Dead Drench.
I have a CD somewhere in my box of recording material. And then in 2001, everything changed in an instant when this young Japanese guy named Takeru Kobayashi came to America and competed in the Nathan's Hot Dog Contest. Kobayashi was different from everyone who had come before him. You know, he wasn't a big man. He looked very healthy. He didn't have any kind of a jokey nickname, right? And it turned out that he had been training for the contest as if it were a real sport. Part of Kobayashi's innovation was that he came up with a completely new way to eat the hot dogs. He separated the hot dog from the bun, and then he snapped the hot dogs in half. And then he would snap the bun in half, dunk the bun in water, and eat it. This was an innovation akin to, you know, the Fosbury flop in the high jump. And the record at that point was 25 hot dogs in 12 minutes, which everybody thought was an enormous quantity. The contest starts, everything is going like normal. And then about 3 minutes in, everything kind of stops. And not only the other contestants, but the announcer, they just start looking at Kobayashi with kind of their jaws open. Kobayashi had almost broken the world record, and there was still 9 minutes left to go.
The kid is incredible.
A total beating of the Americans. He was like a conveyor belt. He was just putting them in two at a time.
And then he proceeded to double the world record by the end of the 12 minutes.
Started waving the white flag.
I can't believe it. The record, new record, 50.
And then after that, everything changed because there started to be real money. Pretty soon, you know, ESPN was broadcasting the hot dog contest live.
Amazing. What a crowd out here. Americans of all stripes, their visitors from abroad, celebrating the dream of independence once again on the corner of Surf and Stillwell.
And with that money came a whole new wave of competitors who, you know, like Kobayashi, were training. They were taking it seriously as a sport, and they weren't necessarily in on the joke anymore. They were really trying to win. Eating is one of the great psychic preoccupations of our species. It's right up there with sex and death. I mean, eating is this animal act that we all participate in to some degree, and this is the most animal version of it, but it's happening in an environment where there are safety rules. So in a sense, it's like this display of gluttony that has been kind of made safe for you to look at and think about. There's like this pane of safety glass between you and the danger. If you sort of zoom out and you think about, you know, what an eating contest symbolizes more broadly, maybe, you know, it does seem symbolic of the outsized American appetite for everything, not just for food, but for resources, power, money, you name it. It's kind of a Rorschach test for how people see us.
Jason Fagoni is the author of Horsemen of the Esophagus, Competitive Eating and the Big Fat American Dream. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQuil.com. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at Lemelson.org. From Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at ProgressiveCommercial.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. United Way of Bemidji and the Community Resource Connections are coordinating storm relief efforts like debris removal and more for residents on private property. Find resources at 218-333-0880 or crcinform.org. And donations to the Discovery Recovery Fund can be made at unitedwaybemidji.org. Nonprofits may apply for funding on behalf of their clients or organizations. Learn about the trees of Itasca State Park Saturday, July 5th at 10:30. Meet outside the Lakeside Museum in the picnic grounds for a talk and short walk. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.